This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Great to have your company this Tuesday. Very soon, Nationals leader Michael McCormack keeps his job. David Littleproud is his deputy. But who will be Ag Minister? And is this the end of the Barnaby comeback? 0467 922 891 to send me a text. I'd love to hear from you. Also this half hour, Canada's love for buying up Australian agribusinesses continues. A Canadian pension fund is a step closer to owning one of the country's largest irrigated agriculture producers and life as a career governess.
Very, very rewarding. And it is. It's really, the line of separation is very, very grey. And it's not a bad thing because you're included in part of the family, but you still have a job to do and you're mindful of that. But you feel treasured and truly cared about.
You'll hear more on that after the weather. But first today at 6 past 12, Parliament has resumed for 2020 with a shake. For the first time in more than 30 years, there's been a challenge for the National Party leadership. This morning, the party room voted to return Michael McCormack as its leader, rejecting a challenge by former leader Barnaby Joyce. It also elected Water and Drought Minister David Littleproud as its deputy. National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan is at Parliament House. Good afternoon, Kath.
Hi there, Bella.
What's happened this morning?
Well, it's been an interesting start to the parliamentary year. Today had been set aside as a day of condolence motions for those affected by the catastrophic bushfires over the summer. But when Bridget McKenzie announced her resignation from Cabinet late on Sunday, it became clear that the Nationals would need to have a party meeting this morning to discuss the leadership. What wasn't clear at that time, but became clear through the course of the day yesterday, was that there would be a challenge to Nationals leader Michael McCormack, and that was coming from Barnaby Joyce, the former Nationals leader. It came about because Lou O'Brien, a Queensland backbencher, said he wanted to put the motion for a leadership spill. Barnaby Joyce said he wanted the leadership back, having left it about 2 years ago. And you will have seen yesterday evening that Resources Minister Matt Canavan actually threw in his cabinet position as a sign of support for Barnaby Joyce, really causing quite a situation that few had expected coming into the parliamentary year, and few had expected when the meeting was set aside, presumably to establish the deputy leadership of the party. But anyway, the Nats had their meeting this morning. Party whip Damien Drum announced that Michael McCormack has been returned as leader, that David Littleproud won the deputy leadership from Nationals David Gillespie and Keith Pitt, and he refused to say exactly how close the ballot was.
Kath, it wasn't that long ago that Barnaby Joyce was telling us that he's sick of the government being in his life. So how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a line that a few Nationals don't mind peddling from time to time. Of course, Barnaby Joyce brings a fair bit of controversy to his leadership challenge. He's been in the parliament, he's been kicked out of the parliament, he's been the leader of the party, he was rejected as the leader of the party. There's been investigations into allegations of sexual misconduct against him by his own party, which were found to be inconclusive. Of course, his extramarital affair with his staffer, now the mother of his two children and his partner, the citizenship woes, and that's all before you get on to his approach to policy. So he's an interesting character, and basically, what he's been saying is that he doesn't think that Michael McCormack is standing up for regional Australians and giving the Nationals enough clout in the coalition partnership. There's been concern about Michael McCormack's approach to business. He's seen as, I wonder, particularly in your state of South Australia, how many people would be familiar with Michael McCormack or could pick him out in a lineup, given that the Nationals don't have such a showing in your state. He does have a pretty he plays a pretty straight bat. He's not one to create a scene or a stir. He has a reputation for going about business quietly behind closed doors. Whether or not he's effective, well, that was, I think, really the point of contention going into the meeting today. I know some Nats are angsty about their coalition partners, the Liberals, potentially taking credit for the government's response to the drought, saying that Scott Morrison is getting the runs on the board where the Nats should be doing it. They say they've lost out on wins to One Nation and independence when they talk about things like the dairy code. So there was a few seeds of discontentment going in, but there were also a lot of people within the party who were disappointed and upset at the way that things were unfolding at this leadership challenge coming into the new year, given that Michael McCormack, you know, did manage to lead the party to what many said was an unwinnable election just, well, less than half a year ago now. Or when was that election? May. Sorry, a little bit over half a year ago. Yeah, a really interesting time for the party. Here's what Michael McCormack had to say about his relationship with Barnaby Joyce when he emerged from that meeting this morning.
Well, the fact is, I've shook hands with Barnaby. We're going to move on. We're going to move on and we're going to work hard together, he and I, and the rest of the National Party team for regional Australians. That's what regional Australians expect. That's what they deserve and that's what they'll get.
Did you ask him whether he'll challenge again?
No, I didn't. I don't expect him to challenge again. I've been endorsed as the leader. I was endorsed as the leader when we came back here after the May election last year. I was endorsed as the leader when he stood down in 2018. So that's three times in less than 2 years. I think that's enough to warrant me leading the party going forward.
Michael McCormack, leader of the Nationals, speaking earlier this morning.
So he's shook hands with Barnaby Joyce. Is this the end of the leadership tension?
Well, I think that a lot of people within the party will be hoping that that is the case, but already speculation is mounting as to when Barnaby Joyce might mount another challenge. We had a statement from Barnaby Joyce a short time ago. It congratulated Michael McCormack on his re-election as leader and said that he'd be pushing for the Nationals to be re-elected. He saw that as a better result for regional Australians, but he said he would now turn his attention to his electorate of New England and focus on the task at hand and the challenge that bushfires and drought and coronavirus, even got to mention, are presenting. But, you know, this challenge was very public. We now know that Barnaby Joyce desires the leadership, if we didn't know it already. We know that he has the support of those in his party. I mean, the high-profile support of Matt Canavan, the resources minister, that's really significant. So too other backbenchers. But your question to the leadership, well, David Littleproud, who is the new deputy, is hoping that this whole episode will be put behind the party. Here's what he said upon his election to the deputy leadership.
This is about hope. This is about vision for our people in regional rural Australia. This is about now back to business. The shenanigans are over. It's time to get back to looking after those people that are facing drought, that are faced up to these fires. It's time for us to focus on them, not us. The party has to focus on that. We will. We've got a commitment from everybody in that room that we have a responsibility as being elected from regional rural Australia to stand here to be their hope in Canberra.
David Littleproud, Deputy Leader of the National Party.
I'm speaking to National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan. Kath, what does this mean for the ministry reshuffle, which was kicked off, of course, by Bridget McKenzie's resignation from Cabinet at the weekend? Who's shaping up for the Ag Minister?
We'd have to say at this stage, Bella, that David Littleproud is the front runner when it comes to the ag portfolio. I was having a look at who's actually held that ministry since the coalition came to government in 2013. And would you believe, I think that Michael McCormack, who's currently acting in the position, is, I think, the fifth agriculture minister. When you think back to Joel Fitzgibbon, Joe Ludwig, Tony Burke in the Labor government before, it's a portfolio that certainly had its fair share of turnover. But given that David Littleproud has held the portfolio before, he's shown himself to be a competent minister as he oversees the water, drought and emergency recovery portfolios, essentially the guts of what the ag portfolio was before it was split and Bridget Bridget McKenzie took on that role. He has emerged as a front runner for that position. There's been less speculation, I suppose, about who will take on the Resources Ministry, given that sort of, I think it's fair to say, was a bit of a curveball yesterday when Matt Canavan resigned from that portfolio to show his support for Barnaby Joyce. So it will be really interesting to see where that goes. A short time ago, the Nationals announced that Bridget McKenzie will remain as the party's leader in the Senate and Matt Canavan the party's deputy in the Senate, with Perrin Davey, the New South Wales Senator, as the whip in the Senate. That sort of suggests that the new Resources Minister or the next Resources Minister may come from the House of Reps. Typically, those roles would go to a Cabinet Minister, but we know that McKenzie has resigned from that, so too Matt Canavan. So less clear as to who will take on the Resources portfolio or who will come into the Cabinet for the Nats. I think that will all sort of be resolved once Michael McCormack gets a chance to sit down with Prime Minister Scott Morrison and organise that reshuffle.
Kath Sullivan at Parliament House, thank you.
Take care, Bella.
Kath Sullivan reporting there. What do you think? Who do you think should be the new Agriculture Minister? And do you think that this is the end of Barnaby Joyce making a comeback, that tilt for leadership? 0467 922 891. You can also give me a call on 1300 222 891 with your suggestion for who you think should be the new Ag Minister. It is 16 past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, Canada's love-in with Australian agribusinesses continues. A Canadian pension fund is a step closer to owning one of the country's largest irrigated agriculture producers. Webster shareholders have backed the $854 million takeover offer from the Public Sector Investment Board. Larissa Smith spoke to Tony Gray from TG Financial about the latest Canadian acquisition in Australian agribusiness.
With their investment strategy, they'll hold. They've split it into areas such as public assets, so or listed assets and credit and private equity. But they also have one called natural resources, and that's focused on timberland and agricultural land and related opportunities. So they're investing around the world in these assets, not just in Australia.
They've had a $2 billion plus spending spree that includes an extensive portfolio of irrigated farmland and water rights, which includes Webster's, but they've had an interest in Webster's for some time.
Yes, that's right. So they're the largest shareholder before this takeover was launched, and at 19-odd%. And they also in 2018 bought some assets from Webster, which were some of the Tandao cotton properties, and that went into a separate joint venture. Webster's have got their divisions, essentially. They have horticulture, which are the walnuts and the almonds, and so PSP will continue to hold all of those assets, and they'll operate those through some of their existing operations. So they have pecans and the like. So the Starman Farms is a non-wholly owned subsidiary of PSP that's already operating in that space. So that will go to that part of the business. There'll be some of the agricultural assets with a value of about $267 million will go into a separate vehicle, Kubar Assets. And the chairman of Webster, Chris Corrigan, and one of the directors, David Fitzsimmons, who between them own just over 21% of Webster, will take on 50.1% of that asset. PSP will own the balance. And that includes a lot of the grazing properties in the Western Districts, some of the apiary, the honey assets that were purchased there last year, and related water entitlements for those properties.
Why do you think overseas pension funds or superannuation funds have taken such a big interest in Australian agriculture when Australian super funds have kind of steered clear of them?
I'd actually think that it's not just Australia. I think that these pension funds are investing globally. So in some respects in Australia, we've got a large superannuation system of our own, and we have a lot of superannuation assets in Australia that funds that have that own offshore assets. It's the countries that in fact don't have these pension schemes and superannuation assets that are seen, that are probably more affected than Australia, because it's one way. They're seeing this foreign money coming in and owning assets, but they're not buying assets offshore themselves. I think for Australia, it's probably a natural place for Canadians, and we're a sizable agricultural market. But I'm seeing two different types of interest. One is the ownership of assets, the land, for instance, and the other is ownership of businesses. So the PSP side has got elements of both, but they'll put the business operating elements into these joint ventures that might have other partners in there. And then separate to the likes of PSP, we've got active businesses that are very large scale. So Nutrien, that bought Landmark, for example, is in the process of taking over Ruralco. Nutrien, at least claim, I haven't verified, but that they're the largest provider of nutrients and crop protection and services and the like. So they've bought active businesses, service sectors to Australian agriculture. It's going to be pretty interesting how that works out, because the first thing that occurs to me is, well, you can have an Australian competitor such as Nufarm, who provide crop protection, and they've expanded overseas, although they have just sold out of some of their South American operations. But they're going to find that some of their largest customers, such as Ruralco, are in fact owned by competitors now.
So your view on investment in Australian agribusiness by investors locally, how do you see that playing out in 2020 when we're coming off the back of a fairly substantial drought and bushfires as well?
Well, most of the agricultural-related stocks have been pretty weak share price-wise. So you can look at Ridley Corp as a stock feed provider, for example, Nufarm that I mentioned earlier. But the share market looks ahead. If we see breaking rains and conditions look as though they'll be improving, investors won't wait for the improved results to come through. The share prices will react early. But in the meantime, it's a happy hunting ground for foreign investors, or any investors that want to go and buy into that sector, if they're taking that long-term view. If we step back to Webster, really they're buying the business at a bad asset value. And we're running here off the directors and independent reports on what the water rights are worth. If you add those in, take off debt, the net assets of that business are a little over $700 million, and that's what the takeover values the business at.
That's Principal of TG Financial, Tony Gray, talking about some of the Canadian interests in Australian agribusinesses, and PSP plans to delist Webster from the ASX. Let's head off to the markets now, and here's John Traeger with the Dublin Sheep Report.
Good afternoon. Quality was extremely mixed and included more Score 2 Merino types, as agents offered 6,000 lambs and 1,500 sheep to the usual array of trade and processor buyers, specialty butchers and restockers. Competition was not as spirited in the previous sale, with prices easing across the market. Extremely late young lambs went to restockers from 56 to 88 to remain firm. Late young lambs sold from $78 to $136, down $5 to $10 per head, reflecting the quality on offer. Light trade types eased $5 to $8 as they sold from $120 to $144. Medium weights remained mostly firm, receiving $140 to $170, with a few heavyweights on offer down $5 a head and selling to a top of $160 per head. Extremely light older lambs eased $5 to $10 as they sold from $96 to $140. Lighter weights sold from $130 to $148, also back $10 to $12 per head. Medium weights eased by a similar amount as they received $130 to $168, with a few supplementary fed heavyweights back by up to $15 to $20 per head as they sold from $176 to $198, with extreme heavyweights also back by up to $20 per head and selling from $180 to a sale top of $230 per head. Light hoggets sold from $100 to $124, with heavyweights receiving $166 to $176. Light mutton sold from $70 to $110, with heavyweights selling from $145 to $188, with both classes easing $5 to $10 per head. Light ram sold from $50 to $60, with heavyweights receiving $132 to $170 per head. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to senior forecaster Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Isabella.
No rain on the horizon today?
Not today. We did have, well, we do have some current thunderstorms forecast for the far northeast, but it's looking unlikely, so not quite sure we'll keep those on for the afternoon forecasts going out. We'll just keep an eye on those, but generally elsewhere, looking at fine conditions, and yeah, it's all under the influence of a ridge of high pressure that's sitting to our south, and that's really going to be our dominant weather driver over the next probably 6 days. Although we do get a bit of an infeed of moisture from the eastern states, so that that ridge is basically producing a east to southeasterly airstream, and we get a little bit of a trough developing over Victoria, and that just helps to bring some moisture in, brings a little bit of instability into the eastern districts from Thursday onwards as well. So we could see a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity developing mainly over the sort of Marylands, Riverlands, south of the northeast pastoral on Thursday, and then just becomes a little more bit more extensive on Friday, just extending to the sort of Mount Lofty ranges mid-north. We could even see a little bit of thunderstorm activity over the northern parts of Eyre Peninsula as well on that Friday, but then starts to contract eastwards again over the weekend. So by the time we get to sort of Sunday into Monday, really not a great deal happening as far as weather goes. But we do have a trough feature moving across in the west on Monday, so we'll see conditions starting to warm up gradually as we get to the sort of latter part of the week over the weekend, particularly in the northwest pastoral, where we'll see a return to some very hot conditions over western parts on Sunday, then just extending a little bit further east on Monday as that trough moves across from the west, just bringing those northeasterly winds, and then we still probably still see some very hot conditions up in the far northwest on Tuesday. But that trough is just going to be to bring a bit of a wind change, not expecting any weather with it, so we'll just see the wind swing from a north to northeasterly round to a southwest, so we will see cooler conditions extending across most of the state during Tuesday. So as I said, yeah, just a gradual increase in temperatures over that weekend period into Monday, and peaking on Monday and then staying to cool down as we head through Tuesday. So yeah, it's not looking too bad across the state, just pretty fine conditions the next couple of days. Yeah, that infeed of moisture into the eastern parts is going to produce some showers and thunderstorm activities during the Thursday, Friday, Saturday period. Maybe a little bit still around on Sunday, but then not much happening during the Monday, Tuesday period. At this stage, was probably thinking generally with the showers over the agricultural areas, you know, it might be around that sort of 2 millimetres. Obviously, with the thunderstorm activity, we could see some of those falls getting up to about 10 millimetres, but yeah, we'll see how that moisture feeds in. We could see some falls a little bit more than that, but we'll be looking at that over the next couple of days. So yeah, not a bad looking week as far as temperatures go across the state. Yeah, much cooler week over most parts, and yeah, it's not looking too bad. No warnings out at the moment. See how things go over the next couple of days. We do have some pretty fresh sea breezes heading our way, but at this stage we don't have any warnings for those, but we'll just be monitoring those and reassessing things on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, not looking too bad across the state for this week coming.
Easy done. All right, thanks, Vince.
No worries.
Vince Rollins there at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the upper western district, tomorrow will be a partly cloudy day. There'll be a high chance of showers in the east and a slight chance elsewhere. The chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. Overnight temperatures will drop to between 17 and 23 and then reaching up to 35 degrees. And for the lower western district, a mostly sunny day with a medium chance of showers in the east, most likely in the afternoon and early evening. There'll also be a chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening. Cooler overnight between 13 and 19 and then getting up to the low to mid 30s. Very soon you're going to hear how South Australia's hemp crop is faring. 0467 922 891 is the number to join the conversation today.
listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway. Isabella Pittaway.
Hello, great to have your company this afternoon. Coming up this half hour, do you feel like a hemp chocolate chip biscuit or perhaps some hemp oil on your salad? Hemp is still a relatively new crop to be grown in South Australia, and you're going to hear from a producer entering their second season of growing it.
We're looking at a process which has been developed in the USA, which can mill that hemp flour more finer. And if that is the result of our investigations, then we can use hemp flour to bake 100% with. And that'll be gluten-free, so there's definitely a market for that.
Plus, what does it take to be a governess? You'll find out about the life of a governess who's worked with 18 families over the past two decades. I wonder what changes she's seen over that time. 0467 922 891 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also call 1300 222 891. It is just after 12:30 with the latest in news headlines. It's good afternoon to Matt Coleman.
Hello, Isabella. Michael McCormack and David Littleproud have been elected as leader and deputy leader of the Nationals in Canberra. Mr McCormack has seen off a challenge from Barnaby Joyce, who tried to wrestle the leadership from him during a party room meeting this morning. Today's meeting was meant to discuss a replacement for Bridget McKenzie, who quit the deputy position amid the sports grant saga. The Melbourne Greens MP Adam Bandt has been elected as the new leader of his party uncontested following the resignation of Richard Di Natale. Under his leadership, he says the party will push for a new Green Deal to tackle climate change, unemployment and inequality. And Federal Parliament has paused on its first sitting day of 2020 to pay tribute to the more than 30 people who have died during this summer's devastating bushfires. Usual business has been suspended as members and senators speak to condolence motions in both houses. ABC News.
Thanks, Matt. The Australian wine industry is seeking a $100 million investment from the federal government to help drive exports and increase wine tourism. Nick Waterman is the president of the South Australian Wine Industry Association, and he's also the managing director of Yolumba Family Winemakers. Good afternoon, Nick.
Good afternoon, Isabella. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Why does the Australian wine industry need an investment of $103 million now?
I guess it's an extension of a really successful program of $50 million, which was under the program of export and regional wine support, which has been rolled out in the last 4 years, and that's achieved some pretty significant results for the industry. And it's an extension of that for us to be able to continue to show growth to the industry and to regional communities and provide employment for people in those regions.
And when you say it's resulted in significant results for the industry, what do you mean?
So the $50 million was broken into a number of different key programs. One of them was to grow our sales into China and the US specifically, and to grow total exports. So we had a target. We had a base 4 years ago of $2.3 billion in exports and a target to achieve $2.8 billion. And currently total exports are at $2.9 billion. And a target, Isabella, of exports of wine into China of $980 million. And they're currently sitting at $1.25 billion, although a little bit shaky, I must say, with things that are going on up in China at present.
And I'll touch on that in a moment, but with this $103 million, I think it's a portion, I think $17 million directly for marketing for the next 4 years. We saw Wine Australia, they had a record marketing push last year in the United States. Can you tell us why that market is so important?
Yeah, the US is important because it's the largest market, wine market in the world, and whilst that's not on a per capita consumption basis, in terms of total value, it represents the largest global market. And because it's potentially, relatively safe in terms of physical security and politically stable, it represents a good market for all wine producing countries, but particularly for Australia, it's a significant market, and we have upside there. I was part of the Far From Ordinary campaign, or a participant in that campaign, which was a roadshow taking Australian family-owned wineries in the main across the US to key cities, and it really showed us as a group the level of understanding of within the consumers and trade in the US about Australian wine, and a desire to understand it in more detail was quite significant. So that was really important. But it can't be something that we just do once and then walk away from, because our competitors, being other countries, particularly Italy, have been doing those sorts of things for years, and it's about being consistent and present in that market so you don't get forgotten.
Nick, how much money does the industry raise in levies, and how much of that is put towards marketing?
In terms of, I don't know exactly, but in terms of levies, the total amount raised, but, you know, at least half of the levies go into market development. Most of the organisations are like SAWHERE, for example, which I'm president. That's a membership-based organisation which is not there to make money in its own right. It has to be sustainable. But all of the levies are put back into various activities, whether that's providing assistance around workplace health and safety, or supporting export programs. Yes, I can't answer your question in terms of the exact amount.
And I'm presuming that if the industry is sort of calling for quite a significant amount of funding, that it will be prepared to match that?
Yes, the current export and regional wine support package, there was a co-funding requirement, and so SAWHERE was working with the South Australian government, South Australian Tourism Commission, where it was a one-for-one. So South Australia received $1 million for driving tourism in South Australia, and the industry contributed $1 million as well. And that went into numerous programs in China, US and the UK about attracting visitors to visit the South Australian wine industries, which was successful. And a lot of program around what Darren Berg's done with the Cube, which has obviously been a great success story.
I'm speaking to Nick Waterman, who is the president of the South Australian Wine Industry Association and also the managing director of Yulumba Family Winemakers. Nick, do you accept an argument that's sort of been put forward, really, that the wine industry gets quite a significant investment from the federal government already when compared to other commodities?
Probably not, understandably. If you look at the wine industry, and particularly for regional areas, I think it's important. But the wine sector, which includes winemaking and growing and wine-related tourism activities, supports over 170,000 people and contributes about $40 billion to the gross output of the Australian economy. So in terms of that, when you say a federal spend of $50 million to support that, I don't think that's unreasonable, particularly when it's matched dollar for dollar. And it is one of our significant export industries and will remain so, for the foreseeable future, we all hope.
And I want to touch on wine tourism, because there's a few things going on. You mentioned what's happening in China earlier. Have you noticed or heard from others in the industry that wine tourism has taken a hit because of the bushfires, but also the coronavirus?
I think it's probably too early to tell from the coronavirus, but definitely the bushfires around the country have had a big impact, particularly in the Adelaide Hills here in South Australia. And there's a lot of support for that community to rebuild and focus on getting back on its feet. They're open for business, and the South Australian government has a campaign to support that. And there's a number of initiatives to help them get through that in terms of understanding some of the damage and re-establishing their businesses. But I think definitely with the lockdown that's happening in China, and China now represents the largest number of incoming visitors that visit wineries. So there's about 150,000 visitors from China each year that come to Australia that visit a winery during their stay. And the expenditure per trip is over $7,000 for people from China. So it's a really important part of the Australian, not only the winery tourism, but just general tourism. So that's no doubt going to have an impact for sure.
Nick, thank you very much for your time today.
No problems. Thanks.
That is Nick Waterman. He is the president of the South Australian Wine Industry Association, and he's also the managing director of Yolumba Family Winemakers. It is coming up to 19 minutes to one.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to be with you this lunchtime. Now, hemp is still a new crop to be grown in South Australia, with producers just starting to grow their second crop. Only a quarter of the seed that was grown last year has been processed, and now Southeast company Good Country Hemp is ready to break into the market with some new products. Grace Whiteside caught up with owner and manager Mick Anderson in Bordertown.
Okay, so there's four products, and they are hemp seed oil, and there's hulled hemp seed, protein meal, and hemp flour. So the hulled hemp seed is just taking the husk off a raw hemp seed and packaging that and selling it into health food stores. The hemp oil comes from cold pressing, and then as a product of the cold pressing, there is a press cake, and we get that processed further in Melbourne, and that results in the protein meal, which is 50% protein, pure hemp protein. And then hemp flour as well.
And speaking of the hemp flour, we have some delicious cookies in front of us at the moment. Tell me a little bit about some of the uses for the flour.
Well, the flour is an interesting product. It can be used for baking, but you can't bake with pure hemp flour at the moment because it's a very dense type of flour, a bit like rye bread, I guess, if you'd try to bake bread with it. So you normally got to mix it up to about 60% hemp flour with another type of lighter flour to get a good result at this stage. But we're looking at a process which has been developed in the USA which can mill that hemp flour more finer. And if that is the result of our investigations, then we can use hemp flour to bake 100% with. And that'll be gluten-free, so there's definitely a market for that. And all the health benefits that come with hemp will also be in that end result, the biscuits or bread or whatever we make.
And we've also got some of your stock of hemp oil in front of us. Tell me a little bit more about that.
It's mainly used as a salad dressing, but you can use it in cooking as well. You can't fry with it because it's not like olive oil. It has a low flash point, but it has a lot of uses in the kitchen.
Are you seeing much demand then for your hemp products?
We're seeing more and more demand as we further penetrate the market. And we've only been on the market now for around 3 to 4 months. So it's new days for us. We've got the back end of the business all sorted now, and now we've got to get into the sales and marketing. So we're finding new people coming to us all of the time and interested in hemp products for inclusion into their food products that they're already manufacturing, like muesli, breakfast cereals, even pet food products, hemp oil into many different types of applications outside of the food industry. So it's really amazing what hemp can be used for. And I think it's only a matter of time when sales will really start to escalate and we'll be looking for more production from our processing plant.
And you were saying just before that you've only processed about a quarter of the seed that you got from last year's harvest. Will you be able to meet that demand and actually supply that demand?
Early on, we'll definitely meet the demand. As I said, our sales are only just kicking off now. So we're just about to do another 1,000 litres of oil, which will take around 4 tonne of seed. So that'll happen early next week. And then very shortly, we'll fire up our hulling machine and we'll be able to hull some hemp seed. And we'll probably look at doing a run of about 5 or 6 tonne of hemp seed there. So we'll be eating into our reserves of hemp seed from last season's crop. However, I think we'll probably just have a little bit left over by the time the new season seed comes in. So I think we've judged our quantities quite well at this stage.
And what are you expecting from this year's season?
We're looking at more seed this year, probably about three times as much as last year. It all depends on yield. Yield is a critical thing, which we're trying to increase, obviously, with our growers and our agronomist. So when sales start to pick up, I think, we'll just have to judge it very carefully and try to keep abreast of the demand, but also keep growers online to keep the whole process going along smoothly.
That is the owner and manager of Good Country Hemp, Mick Anderson. If you've ever had some hemp before, 0467 922 891, if you'd like to get in touch. Still to come on the Country Hour, life as a career governess across regional Australia.
ABC Reading Eggs is the award-winning online program for children 2 to 13 years, with hundreds of self-paced lessons, interactive activities, and e-books aimed at developing confident and committed readers. It's fun and educational and has been helping Aussie kids learn to read for more than 10 years. Use the free 4-week trial to get started. Available for a limited time only at readingeggs.com.au/ABC.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Lovely to be with you this afternoon. It is 14 minutes to one. The ongoing effects of drought, bushfires and fodder prices are forcing the warm blood horse industry to scale back. Benny Rosman is an Irish cross warm blood breeder from Tarpena in the southeast. She says they're reducing their operations because it's getting harder to sell and fodder and overheads are getting too expensive.
We sell mainly to the eastern states and they're in drought and they've had bushfires. So we find the market's a lot harder than it used to be. So we're finding, and to source our own hay and fodder is also getting more expensive. We're having to reduce numbers. So that's just part of how the market is at the moment.
Is it that people aren't buying horses, or is it that your costs of feed and breaking in the horses, etc., are more?
Probably a double whammy. I think people are a lot more financially under pressure. Even those that aren't directly affected by drought are affected by drought. So even a local cafe in an area where there's farming or something, they won't have any excess income. It's the first thing that goes when people are under financial pressure.
In general, how's the industry going?
I think for our pleasure and luxury side of things, I think most people are finding it quite difficult. With us, it's very much a luxury item. So the first thing to go is your luxury items, and people that may have even had three or four horses in the past, they'll probably have cut back to their two favourite special ones. Rather than having a young one sitting in the paddock ready to grow out, they'll very much be down to the bare minimum.
Would things be different if you were breeding a different type of horse?
I don't think so. We're really lucky, as in there's only about six other studs in Australia breeding Irish sport horses. So we've got very much a bit of a niche market. People often ring us, are very specific what they're looking for and what they want. It's just, they only want one of them now instead of two or three.
Are the higher costs due at all to drought and bushfires?
Yeah, because the costs aren't just feed. We'll find that the feed costs here are more expensive, even though we're not in drought in the southeast. A lot of our fodder does go to drought areas, so that inflates our prices. And that then has a flow-on effect. If we send a horse to get broken in or to training, those trainers then have to charge us more, higher fees, because they also have increased feed. And it's a snowball effect, so it's not just our own feed costs, also our training costs, etc., are all increased as well. And unfortunately though, but the market itself has decreased because people aren't spending on luxury items. So we find we're kind of getting higher costs, higher input costs, and we're not getting the market value back as easily.
Ms. Rosman's experience echoes that of the wider warm blood breeding community. Shanna Antrim of the Australian Warm Blood Horse Association says they've seen a significant decrease in the industry in recent years.
It's probably been in a gradual decline, and that's just due to the current climate with finances and ability to access feed. Really been noticeable in the last couple of years, but especially the last 2 years. We have a lot of drought-affected areas. We have branches in each of the states, and all states have been impacted either by fires or drought. So people's primary use of their finances is going just to sustain their animals, keeping them alive with food and water.
And does that have a flow-on effect at all?
It affects us because people aren't breeding as many horses, so therefore they're not registering as many, and then that has outflowing effects with our frozen semen distributors aren't selling as much frozen semen, our stallion owners aren't getting as many services to their stallions. Even discussing personally with my own vet, although the thoroughbred and standardbred industries don't seem as impacted, the smaller and hobby type breeders are not using their services for breeding, so they're impacted as well.
What about breeders who are breeding warm blood crosses? Are they also feeling the pinch?
Yes, they all are. So we have foundation stock, which consists of thoroughbreds and Anglo-Arabians, and then we have a register where we have horses that can be crossed with anything. So it could be warm blood with quarter horse, warm blood with Arab, you name it. As long as it meets our minimum 25% warm blood approved breeding, we can register those horses. So we're feeling the impact from that area as well.
Would you be able to estimate how many breeders are actually downsizing?
Well, I don't have actual figures here in front of me, but a lot of our breeders are either not breeding at all due to the drought and just the ability to get feed, because once you breed them, you've got to be able to sustain them on the other end. Or they just decrease their breeding numbers. So they might have been breeding 10, 15, 20 plus horses a year, and now they might be only breeding one or two.
How can the industry get back up again, and how long would it take?
Well, I suppose Mother Nature will determine that, because a lot of people are having to buy water because dams are no longer there or bores have run dry, so water's an issue. And especially in the hotter climates and in summer, they're going through a larger consumption of water. And then just trying to be able to access hay and feed, it's just getting more and more expensive. So until we get rain to alleviate having to purchase water and having to being able to reduce the cost of hay, I can't see anything happening in the near future unless we get more of those supplies readily available and at a cheaper cost.
That's Australian Warm Blood Horse Association's Shanna Antrim and Tarpena horse breeder Benny Rosman speaking there to Bridget Herman. And speaking of bushfires, news just in this hour, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has written to state and territory leaders proposing that former Defence Chief Mark Binskin lead a royal commission into Australia's bushfire disaster. He's asked them to provide feedback on the draft terms of reference. It is 8 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and Leanne Bright has about 18 families. She's been a governess for more than two decades, much longer, she admits, than most would stay in the job. Now, during that time, she's seen significant technological changes in the schoolroom and also mentored numerous other governesses. Leanne spent the last 3 years at Yathonga Station near Louth in western New South Wales, and she spoke to Saskia Mabin about her life as a career governess.
I had no confidence, like many young people coming out of school. And I just thought, oh, I don't know what I can do. And I'd been working, my parents have a station, so I understood what station work was about. But I just thought, I'd always been interested in kids in that. So it seemed like a logical decision to actually apply for a job in a paper. I drove up to Port Augusta with my friend for an interview from Barra, where I was going to high school, and yeah, got the job. I was so lucky.
Yeah, and then I guess many more jobs followed. How many different families have you governessed for?
Well, I'll say about 18, because I've had a couple of where I've done went with the family for 2 years stints and a three-year stint. So I've been very lucky. One job seems to have followed another.
18 is a lot of families. That's a lot of kids that you've had a big impact on their life in very formative years.
And it's a lot of families that have had a great impact on my life too, because you're very lucky to be included as part of their family, and you get some of the very best things from things I do is because of each of those families and the impact they've had on me, and they've changed the way I think and the way I do things at times.
It's an interesting job to me, because you really do become very much part of someone's family. It's almost like there's no separation between work and home. It's just one in the same. Is that a really rewarding thing for you?
right. It is. It is. There is. It's really, the line of separation is very, very grey. And it's not a bad thing because it's, you're including part of the family, but you still have a job to do and you're mindful of that. But you just, you feel treasured and truly cared about by the families. And they look after you and you just become one of their own and just another part of them. And you've got to remember, there's not that many people living out in the bush at times. So having that extra adult on the place you can actually chat to, it's as great for them as it is for you.
Definitely. I imagine that also makes it really hard to leave and to move on.
Yes. Many of governesses have driven away with tears in their eyes flowing down the face and that. And it's sometimes, and it's hard. I've been lucky the last couple of years working around the same district. I know I'm always going to see the families again. But when I drove away from Queensland, I knew that I probably would not be back to Governor's. And that was really hard. We're lucky now we have social media that we can keep up with our lives. But you just, it's the whole community, the teachers, the other families in the community that you become close to, that you just know that you're never going to, you know, you might not see again.
Tell me about this website that you run as well as doing your governessing work.
I run a website called Governess Australia, and the main body of it is just about information, because parents and governesses alike need information about governessing, and they need to know what we're all doing and what the best way to go about it is. There's not a lot of information out there, and it's a job that's got lots of grey areas, and that's okay. And that's part of my website is going, well, that's okay. You've got to offer what's your job, and every job is individual. What you do for the job, the hours you work are different. I don't know. Very few have the same hours they work because you have different amounts of kids, you have different age groups of kids. So the website is all about giving information for parents, especially new parents just getting into looking at having either a nanny or a governess in their life. They need to have that information about looking at what sort of things people play, what's the average out there, what a good wage and all that sort of stuff. So there's a whole magnitude of information on it.
Yeah. How has your role changed over the 2 decades that you've been doing it? Because I imagine with the introduction of more technology into the schoolroom, things would have changed quite a lot since you started.
I can remember the days when we got a workbook, we worked through and did all the activities and we just posted it back. But you're right, it has changed dramatically.
Snail mail as well, yeah, wow.
Now there's so many more things you have to, I mean, you have to get in and make sure all the computers are running. And there's so much technology you have to manage, making sure printers, computers, everything is going right. And the kids are checking their emails, you're checking your emails, you're answering, you're communicating with the teacher back and forth. You're sending in work digitally, so you need to be all par with how to do that and learn those skills. Back 20 years ago, it was a very lonely job because you're out there and you didn't know whether you were doing right until the set work come back, and that might have been a month later on the mail.
If you were to try and encourage someone who might be interested in governessing and trying it for the first time, and you were to give them a piece of advice or words of wisdom, what would you offer them?
Come out because you won't regret it. It's an amazing opportunity and you get to see a different side of life and nature and all those things that are just truly wonderful, and they make you appreciate what you've got.
That's Leanne Bright speaking there to Saskia Mabin about life as a governess in the Australian outback. We're not too far away from the 1 o'clock news. Let's find out what's coming up on your radio after 1 o'clock with Sonia Feldoff. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, Isabella. Every day we seem to get more and more information about the coronavirus and the impact that it's having. But when you try to get specifics about where and when, a lot of the advice has been pretty vague. Now, I don't know, we're getting this detail. Personally, I don't feel particularly scared about this one, and I'm not quite sure why, because all the evidence, all the news reports would suggest we should be. So we're going to talk with a local GP, Dr. Lena Hinchcliffe, about the advice we're getting and how we should be feeling and whether we're all becoming a bit complacent, whether vague advice leads you to be more fearful or perhaps a bit complacent about things. We'll take a look at that. Now, would you put poo in your compost bin at home? Dog poo, not your own poo.
I'm like, what kind of poo are we talking about, poo. Sonia? I don't have a pet, but I would probably try and use that as a fertiliser if I could.
Yeah? Well, we're going to talk about whether we can get past the ick factor and play you some songs from rich and famous people.
Excellent. Thanks, Sonia. That's all coming up on your radio after 1 or 1:30 across regional South Australia and Broken Hill. It is coming up to news time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.